Okay, this case is called Harris versus the People. And may I have the entry of appearance, counsel?
Good afternoon, Andre Escobar. I'm involved at the Greensboro 664, ABC appointed on behalf of the defense.
Thanks very much. For the AG, please.
Rebecca Jones, registration number 31044, on behalf of the People.
All right, thank you. So this to this case as well, so it's at the 44 minutes, 22 minutes aside. And Mr. Kibar, you need to keep track of your time if you want to use it. So whenever you're ready, sir, you can go.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I know that these issues have been before this court the entire day on the matter of Indiana versus Edwards and whether or not the court should adopt a different standard. And I've been here, so I've heard a lot of these arguments and the questions that the court has been making. So I'll get to, at least for Ms. Harris, the point. And that's that my reading of Indiana versus Edwards is a different standard. Trial is different. And the issue here isn't about competence in a technical sense. It's not about whether or not someone could do a really good question, could introduce evidence, or can cross-examine effectively. It's about mental competence. And for someone like Ms. Harris or someone else who has a mental illness or severe mental illness, the Supreme Court in Edwards is very concerned about letting that person proceed without counsel and whether they're competent mentally to do so. So the Supreme Court in Edwards looked at Dusty, looked at Florida, and said, is that enough? Looked at Godinez, and mispronounced that, my apology. And in my reading, limited Godinez, and said that someone, a defendant, can meet a threshold of confidence for Dusty, or in Colorado for a Bueno, can get through that advisement at some point in the case, whether it's at the beginning of the case or in the case of Ms. Harris on the second day of trial. And actually can get through an Aguero advisement, but still not meet what the court calls a higher level. And in its opinion, it distinguishes the facts that it has in front of it from that in Godinez. And the language, I think it's very telling that it is in fact talking about a higher standard. And it says, quote, "We nonetheless conclude that Godinez does not answer the question before us now. In part, that is because the Court of Appeals' higher standard at issue in Godinez differs in a critical way from the higher standard at issue here. In Godinez, the higher standard sought to measure the defendant's ability to proceed on its own to enter a guilty plea. Here, the higher standard seeks to measure the defendant's ability to conduct trial proceedings. To put the matter more specifically, the Godinez defendant sought only to change his plea to guilty. He did not seek to conduct trial proceedings, and his ability to conduct a defense at trial was expressly not an issue. It made a similar, and Mr. Benezra used the word modification, which I think is fair, modification to Ferretta, not overruling it, but essentially within a narrow class of individuals who fall within this gray area. People who have a severe mental illness who desire to go to trial on their own. How is the court, the trial court, going to handle that if and when it becomes an issue? Now, for some defendants, even with a severe mental illness, it will not. They may get through an Arguello advisement, they may get through the hearing, and they may get through a trial successfully. But essentially, Indiana versus Edwards can, at a minimum, be another tool for a trial judge to use if the trial judge so desires. And says, hold on a second, I've got a concern here. We've reached a point here where I think you're disruptive, where I think that, yeah, technically you understand what hearsay is. You can repeat it back to me. I understand that. Technically, you can answer my questions. You look me in the eye. But you're not conducting yourself in a way that, you know, rather you are conducting yourself in a way that does lead to great concern. And I recognize that that's hard for trial judges to have to do. It's an additional task. among all the other things that they have to do. But with these particular defendants, the need to protect their due process rights, the need to protect the dignity of the proceedings for them and for everyone else is part of that balance.
Don't you think there's a risk that it might actually prove to be too easy for trial judges to do, in the sense that some trial judges may want to say, you know what, I have a grave concern, and I think that you're behaving in a way that suggests to me that we should appoint counsel, force counsel on you. And there's perhaps an ulterior motive on the part of the trial court that I really just don't want to have to deal with. I don't want to have to deal with all of the difficulty that goes with having a pro se defendant at trial.
There is a risk, yes. The number of those risks, though, should be small, I would expect. Because in order to get to this Indiana versus Edwards threshold, it seems to me that we've got to get to a mental illness situation. There's got to be something there that's not just, I don't like pro se defendants because they're doing more work for me.
And so what constitutes a severe mental illness? I asked the question earlier today, and there was the answer, well, schizophrenia was an issue in Edwards.
I think you're going to need to rely on some doctors. Somebody at some point is going to have to evaluate the defendant. You're going to need some information. In all the cases that we've had here today, there's been some degree of an evaluation. Whether or not the person's been found competent or not, it's different. Ms. Harris was found competent in her single evaluation. But you need to have something that you can have a record on, and develop a record as to the mental illness. Those individuals who pass that threshold, yeah, there is a risk, sure, that a judge may lean one way or the other and say, you know what, maybe you're not as difficult in certain situations, but I just don't want to have to deal with it, the hassle. But those numbers should be relatively small, because again, we're dealing with a small number of people who would get to the Indiana versus Edwards issue to begin with. So I don't know that the risk is particularly high in that case. But again, if the record is made, and let's assume there is an abuse of that discretion, there is a situation where, because Ferretta is not overruled, and the defendant's right to self-representation still exists. So if on review there's a concern that the trial court's ruling is not in fact supported by sufficient evidence related to the severe mental issue and how it's affecting your performance, then I think there is a basis to then say your decision was incorrect. But there's that option still available.
And not only incorrect, but structural error, dead bang, reversible error.
That's correct, yes. It would be structural error, and there'd be grounds for reversal if that were the case.
Mr. Gubert, can I read a
just? Yes, please.
Was there actually a diagnosis of a mental illness in this case?
Ms. Harris's case is a little different than the other cases. There was an evaluation. There was a diagnosis. The diagnosis information contained the fact that she had been previously diagnosed with bipolar.
But that's usually reported by the client, right?
That's correct. It's not in this report. So the competency evaluation does not include something to the extent of a schizophrenia or another type of axis one.
Right. And part of the reason I asked that question was because most times the competency evaluations are not trying to diagnose. Would you agree with that?
That's correct.
I mean, they're just basically saying, is this person competent? They're not. I mean, you're asking on the Edwards evaluation a full mental health diagnosis evaluation, which is much more involved than the Edwards, correct?
Yes, that's right. It's different. The evaluation in this case was much more narrow, and again, that's part of the court's understanding in the Edwards case is that.
But most of the evaluation, I don't mean to interrupt you, but most of the evaluations. The competency evaluation is arguably more narrow because they're just looking at whether the person is competent.
Yes.
They're not overly concerned many times with the diagnosis, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct. But their focus currently is, can you assist your attorney? That's the Dusky standard. And they're much more narrowly focused. So every evaluation, I do a lot of trial work, And again, sometimes evaluations are not as broad, I think, as some of the trial judges would rather.
I think the word we've used today is robust, right?
Yes. I think for trial judges with the Indiana versus Edwards standard, trial judges will want a more robust evaluation. The current evaluation scheme is, I don't think, personally, is going to help. Because I agree with you, Your Honor, the focus is much more narrow.
Right, and that's what my concern is. So we would be asked actually creating another level of evaluations to be done.
To be effective, I think so. I think that's the best way, policy-wise, for a trial court to feel more comfortable at some point if they're going to be making these decisions. But that's based on my personal experience. The evaluations that I see right now are much too narrow.
Okay, so let me ask you this, and then I'll quit monopolizing your time. How would that pertain to your client then? What would we do if we do decide to adopt the Edwards standard? Do we remand for a hearing to determine whether she was competent and heightened competency at that time?
It's going to be tricky, but I think Ms. Harris's situation would need to have something done in terms of her an evaluation or evidence regarding her mental health at that time, which is going to be difficult and tricky. And we've had the lapse of time period. It's almost been about 7 years since then. That makes things much more complex. There's things in the record, but it would require interviewing and a lot of extra legwork. But in order to try to figure out, put Humpty Dumpty back together in terms of what that mental state was at the time, it will be easier, obviously, prospectively with future defendants, but Ms. Harris, there's going to be a challenge there.
Okay, thank
absolutely.
You.
Could I take you back to the word modification?
Yes, sir.
You were dwelling on, and with regard to Mr. Nezra's comment. So we were kind of looking at Ferretta and what that language meant, and he, and I take it you were supporting his response that said, in effect, Edwards modified what Ferretta said about waiver. It seems to me that could be because it means for people with this mental illness problem, something different is required for a knowing waiver. But by your going through the things one would have to know about a trial and saying that's not really what's at issue, I take it you're not saying that. The other possibility, which I'm posing to you now, is so in effect, are you saying, do you believe it, Edwards modified Ferretta by saying, if you fall within this category of mental illness, you lose your right to waive your right to counsel? You lose your right to go pro se?
No, I don't think so, because I still think that you can have a severe mental illness, but yet not have it impact what you're doing, is the way I'm still reading Edwards. And its combination with Ferretta, there still has to be some kind of nexus between the two. Because again, we're talking about people who are post-competency determination. So they have been determined to be competent. And they're, nonetheless, we're now at a threshold where they're about to proceed at trial. And there may be some concern at that point as to whether or not they can technically go to trial. Then I think the answer is that for those select groups of people, if there is a sufficient concern, there's facts or some determination by a trial court judge supported by evidence, and hopefully some medical, and hopefully necessarily medical evidence, then I think then at that point, the court can make the determination one way or the other as to whether or not this person should proceed.
That sounds a little bit, to my ear, like you're moving in the direction then of saying, if you suffer from a severe mental illness, you still do have a right to proceed pro se, or you may, but you have to know more in order to waive your right to counsel. Is that right?
It's not no more. It's a recognition that trial group creates for everyone technically larger challenges. But with someone who's got a mental illness, they have to be more sensitive. It's going to be trickier for them to do all the things that's harder for other people to do. And so for those people, you have to be cognizant of the fact that they can react to certain things differently. There's the American Psychiatric Association, amicus argument that's in the Edwards case, talks about all these sorts of issues. Disorganization, paranoia, inability to understand, that for some people with mental illnesses, that becomes even trickier. And in the trial, it's exacerbated. So the old dusty standard about whether or not someone can help you and you can walk along with them and they'll advise you doesn't really apply to someone who's trying to do it on their own. So for those people, the combination with Beretta seems to me to say, look, you still retain the right to proceed pro se. You may have a mental illness, we understand, but you still have the right, if you're able to get through this, to be able to do that. But it's harder to do trauma. It's just mechanically, emotionally, whatever. Generally harder. We have to be sensitive of that. And for some individuals, the gray area individuals, the trial court may look at them and say, this person just can't do it. This person's having some severe problems, there's a history of disruption, and cites certain information. For those people, Indiana versus Edwards says that that person may not, the trial court can say, we're going to impose an attorney for you.
Could I pose just one other position in between then? So it seems like in Ferretta, the U.S. Supreme Court pretty clearly decided your right to go pro se would not depend on your ability to defend yourself, but rather your understanding of your rights and what would be at issue, and therefore whether you could make an intelligent waiver of your right to counsel. Do I hear you saying, with regard to severely mentally ill people, however, the focus shifts and we really will decide your right to go pro se depends on your ability to defend yourself?
In some ways, it sounds like that's what Edwards is suggesting, because it talks about how technically difficult it is to do the trial. So it does sound, when I read Ferretta and Edwards together, that the Supreme Court seems to be saying something different for people who are mentally, suffering from something mentally severe issues, because clearly it's not about technical capacity. I'm a defense attorney. I cringe at the idea of someone going pro se from a technical point of view. But Ferretta and Sixth Amendment and the Constitution, it says that's a fundamental right that everyone has. But nonetheless, for certain people, the dignity of the process, these are parts of the factors the Supreme Court was looking at in Edwards and says we have a category of individuals that we really just have to be careful about them trying a case on their own. And so the technical part for them will carry in. I think trial judges, because they see more trials than anyone, may be best situated to say, look, in my experience, I'm seeing issues here that are going to be very big red flags. And what Indiana versus Edwards says is you have a tool that you can use in your toolbox. And if it's really substantial, and it's something that's a real big concern for you, yes, you can take into account the technical difficulties of the trial and this particular individual defendant's capacity or lack thereof to be able to handle those things under the most stressful situation that they're going to face in the court, and that's the trial itself.
Okay.
So, in this particular case of Ms. Harris, there was what I will concede is an extensive Arguello advisement. The trial court, during the middle of the trial on the second day, advised Ms. Harris, according to Arguello, as to her right to proceed on her own. There had been a history through the case. This is actually Ms. Harris's second trial. Her first trial was reversed based on a failure to provide a theory of defense instruction. And on this particular trial, there was a competency evaluation that was ordered. A lot of her conduct dating back to the first trial was brought up. The fact that she was disruptive on previous court appearances. At one point, she claimed to be speaking in tongues. That she had difficulty working with counsel. All were raised up. The trial court in 2008, this was several months after the Indiana versus Edwards case, did not do an analysis based on Indiana versus Edwards. Did mention at one point during the advisement, that she had been deemed competent. But what we're asking for is an opportunity to have this done correctly.
Counsel, one of the disadvantages of hearing four cases is that I may get the facts a little bit confused, but your client, if I recall correctly, was the woman who was very religious, is that right?
That's correct.
Right. And is it not correct that at some point counsel withdrew his or her request for competency and facts that on the record that she was competent after the hearing?
Her initial counsel was appointed, Your Honor, and they actually did do a competency evaluation. When it was returned, he agreed with the report.
So then it went on, and then it was the second day, things were going bad during the trial. She wasn't happy with what was happening. It was then when she wanted to fire her attorney.
Yes. She had made overtures prior to that.
So she had already been deemed competent.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So this was out in Arapaho, and am I thinking of this one correctly? So at that point, then the judge there didn't really have competency even in front of him, just whether or not, because he'd already decided that motion had been withdrawn. He just had to decide whether she could go pro se, right?
That's correct. So the Aguirre advisement covers about 30 some odd pages. Mm-hmm. And so the trial judge covers a variety of issues. At one point, he does stop and mention the fact that there was a competency report, and then says, you know, she was found competent, and I think she's competent to proceed. So he had taken that into account to some degree, but his analysis based on Ferretta and the case law that was cited, we would argue, suggests more that he felt that once a threshold was reached as to whether or not she wanted to go forward, did he have discretion to say no? And in the trial record, it's not clear that he ever thought that. He never mentioned Indiana versus Edwards or Godinez or Dusky. It was really more of an analysis of Arguello that was going through the trial court's mind at that particular time.
And can I just jump in real quick here before you turn it up? It seems like Edwards pertains strictly to defendants who fall in that gray area, namely those who have severe mental illness. Was your client diagnosed with a severe mental illness such that an Edwards inquiry would have been triggered in this case?
She was not diagnosed by the state hospital for a mental illness that would have triggered Indiana versus Edwards. She had, the report indicates that she had been diagnosed with bipolar. That should have been developed, it was not. That's part of the issue that Justice Boatwright was discussing. So we may be in a pickle with regards to Ms. Harris as to whether or not she would have raised any red flags had the judge even recognized Indiana versus Edwards. He did recognize the issue of competency, though. He just didn't do an analysis based on the analysis that I've been discussing with Indiana versus Edwards.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Ms. Jones.
Good afternoon. Regardless of how this court decides the issue before it today, the court's decision is not going to impact the defendant's case. In the cases before the court today, three out of the four defendants proceeded pro se, and only one case was the defendant forced to proceed with counsel. We've talked a bit today about whether or not Edwards even applies to the defendant in my case or the other two cases where the defendant was allowed to proceed pro se, and it does not. Edwards really only applies to cases where the trial court forces a defendant to proceed with counsel. Now, Edwards does talk about Godinez, and it does talk about the fact that Godinez dealt with the waiver of counsel and whether or not the defendant could enter a plea. However, the court goes further than that. The court goes on to talk about Godinez and states that Godinez really involved a state that sought to permit a gray area defendant to represent himself. And it did answer the question that Edwards has to answer, which was whether or not a court may deny a gray area defendant the right to represent. Now here, people argue that the defendant was not a gray area defendant. But even if she was, Godinez permits a gray area defendant to proceed pro se. Now in this case, the defendant was competent under Dusky. There was a competency evaluation done. After the report was returned to the court, the parties agreed that the defendant was competent. On the second day of trial, when she elected to proceed pro se, there was in fact a lengthy delay of advisement. At that time, the parties agreed that competency was not an issue. And the defendant voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently waived her right to counsel. The court's advisement, again, was lengthy. She was allowed to talk with a public defender before making a decision. The court even suspended proceedings for the day, and she came back the following morning, and again reiterated her desire to proceed pro se. Now, as I mentioned, the defendant in this case is not a gray area defendant. We have no information that she suffered from any mental illness, let alone a severe mental illness. The competency evaluation stated that while she did have some extreme religious beliefs that impact her decision-making, it was not a mental disease or defect that rendered her incompetent. And while the defendant has mentioned many of the defendant's actions in the first trial, which was in 2004, the retrial took place in 2008. And again, Edwards acknowledges that competency varies in time, and the degrees and the interference that a mental illness may have vary over that time. Now again, here we don't have any information at all that she had any mental illness at all, let alone a severe mental illness. But at the time of her trial in 2008, she was deemed competent. And further, not only would she have to show a severe mental illness, but she would have to show that that severe mental illness impacted her ability to complete basic trial tasks. And while Edwards isn't entirely clear on what basic trial tasks cover, it does cite to some case law and offer a little bit of information, but it's pretty basic. It's whether or not the defendant can make motions, whether they can argue points of law, cross-examine witnesses, participate in jury selection, and whether the defendant can address the court and the jury. In this case, the defendant was able to complete all of those basic trial tasks. In fact, the trial court made multiple findings throughout the course of the trial that the defendant was doing an incredible job representing herself. The court indicated that she was incredibly smart. He commented that her cross-examination of one of the witnesses was better than he had seen from some defense attorneys that had, or some attorneys that had appeared before him. Four of her objections were sustained. She objected to a discovery violation, and while the court agreed that there was a violation, it found that there was no prejudice. But the defendant clearly was able to argue her points to the jury. She was able to participate in her defense, and there is absolutely no evidence in the record at all that there was any severe mental illness, and that if that severe mental illness existed, that it in any way impacted her ability to complete basic trial tasks. And again, this was the defendant's second trial. So the defendant already had the benefit of sitting through an entire trial. She knew what the evidence was against her. She had seen how this, how the evidence played out in the earlier trial. And she didn't move to appear pro se until the second day of trial. So the trial court had the ability to observe her prior to her motion to proceed pro se, and in fact noted that she had been, up until that point, participating in her defense, consulting with defense counsel, that he was making motions at her instruction and on her behalf. So the defendant, that the trial court had an opportunity to observe her in the trial setting prior to her motion, and she had the benefit of seeing how this trial was going to play out, what the evidence was, and she could make even more educated decisions on how to proceed. So any difficulty that the defendant may have had in representing herself was not the result of severe mental illness. And as we've already discussed, whether or not her technical legal knowledge, whether or not she had enough technical legal knowledge, isn't the standard that we look at here. I'd also like to note that in this particular case, the defendant had the benefit of additional safeguards in that because this was the second day of trial, the trial court actually appointed the defense counsel to sit as not only advisory counsel, but standby counsel in this case. The court acknowledged that it has an obligation under due process to ensure that the defendant has a fair trial and indicated that if it was concerned at any point that the defendant was not receiving one based on her representation of herself, that he would again ask defense counsel to re-enter as her counsel. But that never happened in this case because the defendant, in fact, did an extremely competent job in representing herself here. Thus, this particular defendant's case is not impacted in any way regarding Indiana v. Edwards or this court's decision. If the court has no questions, I'd ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. I have to admit, I forget whether you have any time left or not, I think. I thought not, yes. Okay, good enough. Just wanted to make sure. All right, I want to thank both counsel and actually everybody in the courtroom here seems to have argued together. So I want to thank all of you for your help with these cases. We'll be in recess until tomorrow.